This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a celebration of world music, an exhibit of images from the Honduran Bay Islands, or a cultural summit, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Three-time Big Easy Award winners for Best World Music Group, Bambula 2000 is celebrating its 20th anniversary with a new CD release, The Wild Bambulas, a blend of jazz, reggae, old-school R&B, and the group's signature Congo Square flavor. Joining me now to talk about what is being heralded as the band's best work in two decades is percussionist, songwriter, and band leader Luther Gray. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
Congratulations on your 20th anniversary and the release of The Wild Bambulas. What are your thoughts on reaching this milestone?
We're very, very excited about it. We've spent the greater part of the last 9 months writing and recording this music, 10 original songs, collaborations from members of the group who have really become very outstanding songwriters.
Now, the word bambula, what does it mean?
The word bambula comes from the Congo, and it's a word that means to honor the ancestors or to remember the ancestors. And of course, so many thousands of people of Congolese descent were brought to Louisiana through Cuba during the slave trade. Even Louis Armstrong says his grandmother told him they were from the Congo. So the bambula also became the most famous dance that was done in Congo Square and became known as a dance of love. But the bambula rhythm goes like boom, 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 boom. So this rhythm has evolved to what we now know as the second line. So the second line is really based on this rhythm from the Congo called the bambula.
Wow. Tell us how the group was formed. This was back in 1994.
We formed the group in 1994 as part of the work that the Congo Square Foundation, now known as the Congo Square Preservation Society, had begun to do. We started the whole tradition of drumming on Sundays in Congo Square. And so I was a member of Percussion Incorporated at that time. And so in 1994, when members of the group kind of went our separate ways, I said I wanted to start a group that kind of reflected Congo Square, but not necessarily looking at its past, but looking at its present and into the future.
And the musical influences that contribute to the sound of Bambula 2000?
We're influenced by the whole realm and breadth of New Orleans music. Music of African descent, Caribbean descent, French and Spanish descent, of course, indigenous people here. So it's really a music that's influenced of world music style, but we gave it our own touch, which is kind of influenced with reggae, R&B, funk, and the contemporary styles of music. So we kind of blended all these things together.
So what can we look forward to on the new CD, The Wild Bambulas?
The title song, it really describes our history over the last 20 years. And it's in a Mardi Gras Indian bambula style of rhythm. But it's got that New Orleans jazz, acoustic piano, trumpet, and drums that really predominates. Songs just kind of go from there. We really kind of have social themes in a lot of our songs, but the musical styles of each song is different.
And you have one called Bambula Crazy.
Oh, that's a great song. A good friend of ours named Ernie Smith, who's a great singer-songwriter from South Africa, came to New Orleans last year and he played with us at Jazz Fest. We were working on the CD, so we sat down with him and we were telling him about what we all went through during Hurricane Katrina. And so the next day he had a whole song written about it called Bambula Crazy, but it's really talking about how the hurricane came, we were like washed out to sea, but then a boat rescued me. And the boat was someone who loves and cares for you, like our families, how people really came together and helped us. And so it's really like an Afro-pop New Orleans blend, but it tells that New Orleans story, but in a unique way. It's not like looking at it straight on. It's a love song, really influenced by how people were in love with each other, families. They don't let you hang out there. They really make sure you're safe.
When the storms of life came crashing on my door, and the strength inside me I could find no more, you held on to my hand, helped me to understand that I can't make it through the rain.
And you close out with one of your compositions, South African Sunrise.
In 2011, I was really blessed to go to South Africa with Ernest Kelly and his organization. We went to Durban, South Africa. We went to Johannesburg. We were in Soweto on Nelson Mandela's 93rd birthday. So we arrived in South Africa the night before his birthday. So that morning we woke up, the whole country's in celebration. And so that song is really inspired by seeing how the people of South Africa really came together to fight apartheid and overthrow it. And they did it with song and dance and just organization and many young people. You know, so that song is really a description of that whole trip.
Who are the people that make up the band?
Bambula 2000 is a unique group because not only are we musicians, but we also have dancers. So we have the amazing Bambula Queens led by Queen Mama Jamila Peters Mohammed and Kai Knight. They're both dancers, choreographers, and teach dance. We have the Bambula Warrior or Peacemaker. That's Torrance Taylor, who's also a dancer and educator. And then the band consists of Cameron Woods, who plays drums. He produced probably recorded 8 songs on at his home studio. His wife, Cheryl Woods, they're great songwriting team. She plays bass and sings. We have Drina Clay, who sings. We have Eric Hornsby, who plays keyboards, Jeremy Thomas on trumpet, Clark Richardson on Dun Dun, and myself on all the percussion.
When did you begin to play the drums?
My father was a musician. I was born in Chicago, so I think I inherited this love of music. He played clarinets and reed instruments and saxophones. But when I was growing up, I just always loved the sound of the conga drums. It was in the 60s. I was listening to Curtis Mayfield music and a lot of Temptation, Motown things. It was always had these congas in there and just appealed to me. I really got my first drum when I was a sophomore in high school, and I was involved in a gang fight in my neighborhood. And so the next day, I asked my father to take me to a music store because I knew I was going to be going outside for a while. And so we went to a music store and I got my first drum. And we went to a bookstore and I got some books like Before the Mayflower, the autobiography of Malcolm X. And I started really reading about our history. And I started reading about, even in Chicago at that time, I read Blues People by Leroy Jones and Mario Baraka. And he talked about Congo Square. Little did I know that decades later, I'd be living in New Orleans. I think my spirit just led me to the drum. I always have this philosophy that bad little boys are the best drummers because they got all this energy. But if you don't know how to channel energy, like if you do it through playing music or playing sports or you find your passion, you can channel all that energy in that direction. But if you're on the streets and perhaps you get into a violent situations, then you're kind of caught up in something that you don't really want to get involved in. So I think that's kind of my story.
So you're saying that the conga drums kept you away from gangs, kept you away from the streets of Chicago.
It did. The whole process of drumming and that energy, you kind of get a deeper sense of who you are instinctively. And I think that's really the power of drumming.
So what do you see for the future of Bambula 2000?
We're planning a 20th anniversary tour all throughout this year. We're trying to get to Chicago for a big African Arts Festival during Labor Day. And we're working on an invitation to go to South Africa in December. I think we're in a renaissance in New Orleans, and I think if all of the different art organizations and cultural organizations can work together, we're in a time where we can really not only raise New Orleans up, but also influence the world like we did 100 years ago when the emergence of jazz.
Luther Gray, band leader, percussionist, and songwriter with Bambula 2000. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Bambula 2000 will celebrate the release of their new CD, The Wild Bambulas, at Sweet Lorraine's Jazz Club, 1931 St. Claude Avenue, Saturday, with shows at 8 and 10 p.m. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO. I'm Diane Mack. A primitive island off the coast of Honduras is the focus of Images from Paradise, an exhibit of drawings by New Orleans artist Madeline Faust, currently on view in the second-story gallery in the New Orleans Healing Center. Madeline joins us now to talk about these works that are being revisited as Giclée prints in a unique exhibit. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Images from Paradise. These are works created 25 years ago?
Yes, they are.
What inspired you to revisit them now?
I recently took a trip to Roatan, and the landscape brought back the memories of this very intense time when I stayed on the island and did a series of drawings. They had been flooded in Katrina and ruined, and so I decided to recreate them from what was left. I still had the old corrupted originals.
What island were you on when you created the works originally?
The small island, they call it St. Helene, and it's really a little peninsula off of the far end of the island of Roatan, the largest of the Honduran Bay Islands.
And what were you exploring initially?
I had always wanted to go to the Caribbean, and as fate would have it, somebody offered to let me stay in this house for as long as I wanted, free of charge, as long as I would report back the condition of the house. She had built the house about 3 years before and had lived there, but then had to go back to the States, and she didn't know the condition. And if somebody that she knew would go down there and stay, that was fine. So I volunteered.
And you called it a period of self-imposed exile?
Yes, it was, because I knew that I was going into very primitive conditions. The house had had a generator, and it had cisterns. The generator would run the electricity, which ran a refrigerator and a stove, and would pump the water from the cisterns up to a little water tower that then gravity would bring it down. But she said, I don't think there is anything left. I'm sure it's all been stolen, so it's going to be extremely primitive. But it was at a time in my life when I was looking for solitude.
And in looking for solitude, what did you find that hit that creative nerve?
Being an artist, I went loaded down with Prismacolor color pencils, watercolors, and of course drawing tools. But when I got there, the light, the sun was so bright, the sand was so white, the reflection off of the water was so bright that everything during the day was made high contrast. Color just wasn't really an issue. So I never used the watercolors or the color pencils and stuck with the drawing medium. And it was so exotic, and the light was everything. And I just began to draw. I have two different types of drawings. There are some with gold, and these are the gold Sharpie, and these are the ones that were, I would pick up an object off of the beach or something during the day, and the nights were so long and dark and hot that I could not sleep. The first week and a half, I could not sleep, and I stayed up all night drawing by candlelight these objects that I picked up. The shadows off of the votive candles that were thrown onto my drawing paper were intriguing to me, and I traced them. And in the daylight, I would look at it and say, well, those patterns need to be filled with something. And gold was the obvious choice because the light there was everything.
So what will we see in this exhibit when we come to the gallery?
You will see some drawings that they're almost Asian, Eastern-like. They're very quiet, meditative-type compositions, graphite and gold. And then I have some that are more documentary of the people and the animals and the scenes that I saw there. You will see seashells, banana trees. You will see mangrove swamps, coconut palms. You will see people, dogs, fish and sea urchin skeletons and brain coral and light. Basically all that I experienced there.
Now, the exhibit is installed in what you call a narrative chronological format. What does that mean, and why is this such a unique exhibit?
All the pieces are numbered, and interspersed with the pieces is text. You get a feel for my experience there, my first week, my second week, as things open up. By the time you get to the end of the exhibit, the quality of the drawing has changed. It's become a lot more full of imagery, a lot happier and less lonely looking. And the very last piece, it seems to be sad, which sort of portrays the way I felt. I did not want to leave. I just did not want to leave. And this body of work, I've never made anything like it. I'd never made anything like it before or since. It was particular to the experience and to that place.
Now, you are known for large public sculptures. Will people be surprised by the drawings?
I think that they will. I was classically trained, and I love to draw. In fact, I have sketchbooks of drawing. that's not something that I show because I don't know why.
Tell us more about your background and how you were called to create art.
My mother was an artist. She had gone to Newcomb, and she loved to work with pastels and oil paint, and she would continue to draw while I was at home with her as a very young child. And I suppose I got some of her genes because I have always been creative, and not just drawing, but making things and decorating things. And I'm very physical. I've always had to, like, manipulate my environment. I ended up getting my master's degree from Tulane University in sculpture. I got my bachelor's from LSU in painting and drawing, and my graduate degree from Tulane in sculpture, and then made sculpture ever since.
How are you hoping audiences will connect with this exhibit?
I see it as like a performance piece, something that they can come and see and experience, a bit of entertainment. So they read a book and they were able to experience what I had experienced on the island, which was extraordinary.
So paradise is just a few steps away?
Yes, paradise is just a few steps away at the Healing Center.
Madeline Faust, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you so much, Diane. It was a pleasure to be here.
Images from Paradise by artist Madeline Faust is on view in the second story gallery in the New Orleans Healing Center, 2372 St. Claude Avenue at the corner of St. Rock. There will be an artist reception on Saturday from 5 to 7 p.m. Are you ready for the tricentennial? That's the question being asked as New Orleans artists from all disciplines prepare for the 6th annual Douglas Red Cultural Summit at the Ashe Cultural Arts Center. The day-long event honors the legacy of visual artist and cultural activist Douglas Red, a co-founder of Ashe. Joining me now is Ashe Associate Director Joanne Miner. Welcome.
Thank you.
What is the focus of this one-day cultural summit?
To call together artists, cultural entrepreneurs, and people of all aspects of the business to start thinking about what they can do to participate in the activities that will be going on during the city's tricentennial.
Why is it important to engage the local arts community in the celebration of the city's 300th anniversary?
I like to think of it this way. If you ever heard the phrase, a rising tide floats all boats, well, that is true so long as you don't have a hole in your boat. So what we're looking to do is engage the cultural community to find the holes in the boats and plug those holes so everybody can participate.
Which artists are being targeted?
Visual artists, performing artists, culinary artists, cultural ambassadors, cultural workers, Mardi Gras Indians, social aid and pleasure clubs, all of those entities that make New Orleans as attractive as it is for tourists.
So this is a focus on the African-American arts community?
Absolutely. This is the beginning of a four-year plan that will culminate in the city's tricentennial. So we're hoping to bring together people for not only collaboration, but for coordination so that we are not stepping on each other's toes as we're creating business opportunities, as we're creating programming, as we're creating concerts, theater, that we can help each other succeed.
Who are some of the panelists and what are some of the subjects that will be addressed?
Well, we'll have a morning panel, an afternoon panel, and at lunchtime we'll have a keynote address by Reverend Dwight Webster, who's the founding pastor of Christian Unity Baptist Church. And the morning panel will be moderated by Lynetta Gilbert, and the panelists will be Mark Romig, President and CEO of the New Orleans Tourism and Marketing Corporation, Carol Bebel, the co-founder of Ashe, and Flozell Daniels, President and CEO of Foundation for Louisiana, and Ron Markham, who's the New Orleans Jazz Orchestra CEO. And the purpose of that is to talk about what are the conditions, what are the top line thoughts, what is the environment for cultural entrepreneurship. Then the afternoon panel will focus more on specifics, looking for ways that people can improve their own organization to participate. And the panelists there will be Andrea Chen of Propeller, that's an entrepreneurial incubator. Vincent Sylvain, who's the president of Polycamp. And if you've ever read the New Orleans Agenda, you've seen Vincent's work. and Isalama Diof Henry, who's the founder of Infungata Incorporated.
What is Infungata Incorporated?
Infungata is a nonprofit organization that works to showcase dance and visual arts and African-focused arts.
Now, the summit honors the legacy of Douglas Redd. Tell us about the artist and his efforts in our city's cultural community.
Douglas Redd was a cultural activist, an artist in his own right, and a leader of visual artists, especially in the Central City area. If you have ever attended Jazz Fest and you've enjoyed the visual, the sights, the sound, the feel, the vibe of Congress Square, then you've enjoyed the work of Douglas Redd. Doug was very giving in how he created art, and he was also very inclusive, making sure that everyone, whoever had a vision, whoever wanted to participate, that he was able to open his arms and give of himself and make sure that you were able to reach for what your objective was.
What is your hope for artists attending the summit? How will they grow from this experience?
We'll hope that they see themselves as being fully engaged, fully competent, fully deserving of their portion of whatever is happening in the city's tricentennial. It's our aim, our goal, to help people realize their own vision.
It's also your contention that the old phrase, starving artist, that there really should be no starving artist?
They should not be a starving artist, as essential as they are. We're hoping to change artists' view of themselves as being essential to what's happening here in the city. The reason why New Orleans is that cultural draw that it is.
Joanne Miner, Associate Director of the Ashe Cultural Arts Center. Thanks.
Thank you.
The 6th Annual Douglas Redd Cultural Summit will take place at the Ashe Cultural Arts Center, 1712 Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard, Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at wwno.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.